This is Digital Story Podcast number 725, February 11th, 2020. Today's theme is Why Smaller Sensors Will Make a Comeback. I'm Derek Story. 2019 was certainly the year of the full-frame camera. At great cost to the bottom line, we saw large sensor offerings from Canon, Nikon, Panasonic, and Sigma. Meanwhile, Fujifilm and Olympus doubled down on their respective APS-C and Micro Four Thirds devices. That seems crazy, doesn't it? Well, maybe not, because I think, thanks to computational photography, we're going to see a second coming of the smaller sensor. Tune in to find out why. Just a few days ago, I found myself on a lovely beach at twilight. I was standing there with a very modern Olympus camera, shooting sunset pictures with rolling waves in the foreground. Set to a low ISO and an astonishing shutter speed of 1/2 second, my handheld shots displayed a lovely softened ocean thanks to the water motion combined with a longish exposure. A colorful sky with a perfectly sharp setting sun, and virtually no noise to contend with at all. How could this be possible with a Micro Four Thirds camera housing a sensor that is, you know, Micro Four Thirds, right? Not full frame, and already quite a few years old. Well, the specific answer for this particular setting that I was talking about is a feature called Live ND. Live ND. And what happens is that in camera, it composites exposures to replicate the look of a single image taken at a slower shutter speed. Now, the broader answer to this is computational photography, right? That's what's going on. I mean, these newish cameras have very powerful computers inside of them. They have software that is extremely intelligent. And guess what? What does that sound like? That sounds like smartphones, right? And for some time now, photographers have been asking for smartphone features in their interchangeable lens cameras. Now, in 2020, that request is being answered. And the ramifications of this are tremendous. If, for example, you didn't need an expensive large sensor beast to photograph handheld in low light, well, wouldn't you be at least a little bit curious? Think about all the benefits for travel photographers who don't need to lug large lenses and tripods all across the planet. All of this thanks to smaller sensors, resulting in smaller camera bodies, resulting in smaller lenses that attach to those smaller camera bodies. But they've fallen out of favor, right? A little bit. Now, for me, no. For many of you, no, because I think we already understand what's going on here. But even if we're dedicated to APS-C cameras, and I'm thinking specifically of those by Fujifilm right now, or Micro Four Thirds cameras, and I'm thinking specifically of Olympus, and then, of course, Panasonic too, at least half of Panasonic, right? The non-full frame half of Panasonic. Even if we're already, you know, dedicated to those cameras, it doesn't hurt to have a little extra ammo about why, you know, because our why happens to be, for the most part, we really enjoy shooting with them and they make great pictures. But if you get in some sort of nerd talk with somebody, it's great to have a little bit more ammo so that the other person understands your position beyond, I just like the way this camera looks and it takes really pretty pictures, okay? So what I want to do right now is talk about five aspects or five reasons why I think smaller sensors are going to really make a comeback starting this year and moving forward throughout the decade. Yes, 2019 was, I think, the year of the full-frame sensor, all those new cameras, all the buzz around that. But I think 2020 and beyond, we're going to see a lot more activity from cameras with smaller sensors in them. All right, so let's get to the five reasons why I think that's going to happen. First of all, Micro Four Thirds and APS-C sensors, they're gigantic compared to the sensors in an iPhone, right? They're gigantic. I mean, if you've ever seen a sensor in an iPhone and then you see it compared to Micro Four Thirds or APS-C, there's a big difference. But yet, look at the amazing quality that you can get from that tiny sensor in your iPhone. That is a perfect example of the power of computational photography. Now start to apply that same computing horsepower to Micro Four Thirds and APS-C, and you see why I'm really excited about the possibilities of smaller sensor cameras. Now, the example that I'm using for this show, and it's only one example, there are other examples as well, but I'm using Live ND, which is live neutral density right now, as an example of the power of computational photography to give us more flexibility and higher quality with our work. If you haven't had a chance to play with EM1X, the way that it works is that you just set, set Live ND, and you choose even the density of your ND filter, and then the camera basically takes it from there. And it does, you press the shutter. I like to turn off the preview. You can have a preview in the viewfinder, you can turn it off. I just have it so it just sort of blanks out for a couple seconds. It takes a series of exposures really fast, and then using, really intelligent software, it blends those exposures into what appears to be a long exposure, a great exposure, and a virtually noise-free exposure. all of it, and it just happens like that. And I know it just happens like that because I have used it a number of times. So that's just one example of the things that we can do with computational photography. And we're already thrilled about it in our iPhones, in our Google phones, in our Samsung phones. We're going to be thrilled about it in our larger interchangeable lens cameras as well. Second point is that smaller sensors can be virtually noise-free. This is one of the justifications that people use when they switch to a large sensor camera is that, well, I don't like noise. I like to be able to shoot above ISO 400. Something really snotty like that. Well, that's not very nice, is it? I mean, you can shoot much higher than ISO 400 on a Micro Four Thirds camera or a Fujifilm camera. No problem at all. And even natively, even if you're not doing anything that uses computational photography, you can get very good image quality on an Olympus camera at 1600, a good image quality at 3200. Beyond 3200, yes. Natively speaking, then a larger sensor with larger photo sites is going to do better, is going to have less noise natively. But see, that's the whole key to this. We're not just talking natively anymore. We're not stuck in the thing where you have a sensor this size or that size or that size, and then whatever the technology is for that sensor alone, that's what you're stuck with. That's what I'm saying. That's going away. Now you have a sensor this size, that size, or that size. And then on top of it, you have computing horsepower and technology to maximize what comes out of that sensor and also creatively interpret what comes out of that sensor as well. And one of those things can be a reduction of noise. Have you ever done the thing in Photoshop where you're shooting a night scene and everything's stable, right? So you're just buildings and silhouettes of trees, stuff like that. And then you have a sky. If you just shoot it one frame, then you might get a little bit of noise. And this was, a few years ago when that would definitely crop up. But if you made, five different exposures of it, and then in Photoshop, you stacked those exposures, the noise in the sky and the continuous tones would cancel itself out. And you would have, virtually a noise-free image just by stacking, multiple exposures of the same scene. And essentially, on the most basic level, that's what cameras can do right now. That's what the EM1X can do right now. And so it can take care of that, but it takes care of it in camera, and it takes care of it very fast. You know, in just a second, it can do all of that work. So again, you know, smaller sensors can be virtually noise-free because now they have this assist of hardware and software inside the camera. Smaller sensors mean smaller lenses. So this is a part of physics that's very nice and works in favor of smaller sensor cameras. One of the best lenses that Olympus makes is the 40 to 150 millimeter f2.8 pro lens. And then if you're really living large, you'll have the 1.4x and the 2.0x teleconverters to go with it. Now that lens has basically a effective focal length, right, of 80 to 300, just sitting there because of the size of the Micro Four Thirds sensor. So you could walk around with just that lens in a wildlife situation where wildlife is, you know, you can see the wildlife. It's not, you know, way across the field, but it, you know, it's relatively within reach, and just shoot amazing shots with a lens that, you know, I don't know, it's size of a bag of coffee, right? A pouch of, you know, a 13 ounce bag of coffee, you know, that size, you basically have 80 to 300. You add the 2X teleconverter, right? And then suddenly you have an effective focal length of 600 millimeters, handheld, right? F5.6, 600, handheld, because you have, you know, built-in image stabilization. That's just crazy. Again, in a lens that is the size of a bag of coffee. All right. So smaller sensors mean smaller lenses. And I just can't emphasize, you know, how wonderful that is. Not only is it just for travel that your lenses are smaller and your bag is smaller and everything's lighter and all that kind of stuff, but it also reduces costs for making the lenses. You can make these really great lenses for less money. That 40 to 150 Olympus Pro lens, F2.8 Pro lens, you can get for around $1,200. $1,200 for a lens with that functionality. You know, that is crazy. So this is something that is not lost on people who are already shooting with Olympus cameras, Panasonic Micro Four Thirds cameras, and Fujifilm cameras. It's not lost that they don't need lenses as big as the other guy shooting full frame. Practically any effect can be digitized in camera. And this is something that, again, we're seeing thanks to smartphones and the apps, especially apps developed for them. We get to see the future of what is already coming or will be coming to interchangeable lens cameras. So you want creamy bokeh in the background? Well, essentially there's an app for that, right? There's a technology for that. There's an algorithm for that. You want edge-to-edge sharpness? That can be enhanced as well with software and hardware. You want in-camera diffraction reduction. So like on a Micro Four Thirds, you want to be able to stop down to F16 or F22, but you're worried about diffraction. That can be addressed through software. There's an algorithm or a technology for all of these things, and the sky is truly the limit. This doesn't just apply to smaller sensor cameras. This can apply to a Sony full frame camera as well, and probably will. But that's not the point. The point is that I don't need to have that $4,000 Sony full-frame camera to get some of these goodies. I can get those same goodies in a $1,300 Olympus Micro Four Thirds camera, brand new Olympus Micro Four Thirds camera, and have less weight and have smaller lenses. So the technology can be applied to any size camera, right? Any size sensor. But it becomes, I think, more valuable with the smaller sensor cameras because of all the other benefits that we get as a result. And the fifth point is, this can lead to substantial cost savings for photographers. If you don't think prices are going up, because of reduced demand for interchangeable lens cameras, thanks to smartphones, primarily, then think again. Because as these production cycles continue to shrink, as fewer cameras are coming off the production line, the price is going to go up. Okay, it's going to be more expensive per unit to have these interchangeable lens cameras. One of the ways to offset those price increases is with smaller, smarter cameras that are cheaper to make, right? Because the actual technology inside the camera, the computer, the software, and so forth, you know, those costs can be mitigated. Those costs can be quite affordable. The stuff that really is expensive is, you know, building big, complicated lenses. That cost is much tougher to bring down, okay? So this could be one of the ways that as we move through 2020 and beyond, and we see these rising costs because of these more limited production runs for the cameras that we absolutely love, the smaller sensor cameras can help offset some of those costs because they don't cost as much to make. Now, none of this takes into account the amazing things that we can do with our images once they're in our computer, right? We have just been talking about in-camera stuff, and the in-camera stuff is super impressive. But beyond that, it's not like the computer side of things, you know, our laptops and our desktop computers running the latest software. It's not like they're standing still. They're not. They continue to improve. In Capture One Pro, you have, you know, diffraction correction. You have optical correction. You have, you know, a lot of that stuff built in there already. There's software where you can sample up so you can double your resolution without, in all honesty, a noticeable loss of quality at all. So you can go from a 16 megapixel sensor to a 24 megapixel sensor, no problem in software, by sampling up and by using those advanced algorithms. Same thing with noise reduction. If you do end up with a little bit of noise because you really push the envelope with your smaller sensor camera, that can be addressed artfully and with high quality in software on your computer. Special effects, same thing. I mean, again, the sky is really the limit. So you combine what we're able to do and what we're going to be able to do on the computer with the evolution that's happening inside our cameras, the smaller sensors, and you go, you know what? That's really old school thinking, you know, that I have to have, this big chunk of sensor in a camera and all the physics that, you know, come along with that in this modern age. It's just not true, and it's going to be less and less true as we get through the years. And because of these reasons, and because as people catch on to what I'm talking about here, and like I said, many of you already have, you know, you are the choir, then I think we're going to see a rise in sales in these smaller sensor cameras. I think they're going to have an upswing, and I think we're going to see a bit of a resurgence from folks that are making those cameras. Now, Fujifilm is already hanging extremely tough and doing well. Olympus is hanging in there and I think is going to do better. And what's really going to be interesting is to see what happens to someone like Panasonic that makes both Micro Four Thirds and full frame, and to some degree even Canon, who's going to come out with APS-C, new APS-C cameras, and their full frames, Nikon as well. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens with those camera manufacturers. Are those smaller sensors, going to jump in sales? Are they going to put the necessary resources into developing the hardware and software to optimize those smaller sensors? Or are they going to say, hey, we have a large sensor camera in the lineup. We don't want to cannibalize that. So we're not going to give you, you know, the sophistication under the hood in our smaller sensor cameras. Well, you know, Olympus is going to give you everything they have. And you know, Fujifilm is going to do that as well. So I think this is just going to be a fascinating period. I just wanted you to have a little bit more ammo, a little something to think about. And, you know, right now what I would do as soon as you get home, if you're on the road listening to this podcast, I would pull out my Micro Four Thirds camera or my Fujifilm APS-C and say, Thank you. And I know there are firmware updates in your future, and I know this is going to be a beautiful partnership for a long time to come. You want a high-quality wide-angle zoom? Take a look at the Olympus Digital ED 7 to 14mm f2.8 Pro. So I got my hands on one of these this last week. I haven't bought it yet. I think I'm going to, but I was able to borrow one, the 7 to 14 f2.8 Pro. So again, effective focal length of 14 to 28. And boy, what a beautiful lens. So, you know, another knock on small sensor cameras is that, you know, it's harder to do wide angle photography with a smaller sensor. And it is harder, but lenses like this suddenly make it feel like it's not an issue at all. You know, this is a perfect lens for travel photographers, landscape assignments, and really for anyone that wants to work in tight quarters. The 7 to 14 f2.8 Pro, it measures 3.11 inches by 4.17 inches and weighs only 1.17 pounds. It's nice and it feels really good and it looks great on the camera. It has this really nice built-in lens hood. It's a fixed lens hood. It's got that nice dome front glass. Yeah, oh, it's so beautiful. You get 114 degrees to 75 degrees, you know, in terms of angle of view with this lens. I was shooting with it a lot at 7 millimeters just because it was so nice. I've had a chance to review the images on the computer at 100%, and they're gorgeous. That's the only way I can say. They're just beautifully sharp. They're very nice. They're very nice. It's also weather resistant. It's fast focusing. It's a quality lens. I mean, this lens will serve you for many, many, many years. Many years. If you have your standard lens, let's say that you have, a 12 to 40. That's kind of your standard zoom. If you have the 7 to 14 and then the 12 to 40, and then in all honesty, if you had that 40 to 150 I was talking about, and maybe just throw in one prime lens in there, you have a killer kit. You have a killer kit. The 7 to 14, it's currently available for $1,299. I have a link to it in the show notes if you want to take a look at it. I was just excited because, as I said, I got to shoot with it last week, and I absolutely loved it. I just felt like you should know about that. Okay, I have an update for our 2020 photography season. I want to talk about the Humboldt Redwoods workshop, all right, that's coming up here. It will be May 12 through 14, 2020. And really, you know, it's I say get there a day before May 11th and hopefully stay an extra day or so. But the actual workshop itself, the actual 3 days of the workshop are May 12 through 14. So those of you that are on the reserve list, registration packets are going to go out later this week. And it'll have the preliminary itinerary in there. It's going to have room pricing. It's going to have, you know, all the goodies, you know, that you need to finalize your plans. And of course, it'll be your opportunity to pay the workshop fees, the balance of your workshop fees, and secure your seat there. The other thing that happens is that once someone registers, pays their tuition, then we go to the next level in terms of planning. So suddenly, you know, their name now and their preferences, what they want to do with their stay in Humboldt County, all that gets, you know, locked in. We start working with our friends over at the Redwood Riverwalk Motel. So all that stuff gets dialed in at this phase. So this is really an exciting part because this is when the workshop becomes real. Now, we do have one seat that opened up. We were sold out and one seat opened up because we had one of the people on our reserve list move to a different workshop. So we have a seat open for the Redwoods. So if you're interested in doing this, and I tell you, if you haven't done this, I would be interested. Then we do have a seat open. You can go over to the 2020 workshops sign-up page, and that's at thenimblephotographer.com, thenimblephotographer.com, and just go to workshops, and you'll see now that I've opened up another seat in the Humboldt Redwoods, and you can go there, just get on the reserve list. There's a $100 deposit. Then that puts you right front and center into what's going to be happening here over the next week or two. You'll get a registration packet and all those good things will happen. If you have a question about this workshop, and people do, right? Because, you know, they go, well, I'm trying to figure out the best way to get there. And, you know, the thing that I have to say about that is that really cool places to take pictures sometimes require a little bit of effort to get there, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're pristine and beautiful, and we're not going to be running into a ton of people, because if it was, you know, just an exit off I-5 in California, then, you know, okay. I mean, if it was right next to LAX airport, then yeah, it would be easy to get to, but then no one would want to go there. So these do take a little bit of planning, but that's what I'm here to help you with. I'm here to help you, you know, figure out, okay, if you're flying in, you know, Eureka Airport is like the great place to start. And then it can help you get from the airport to the workshop itself. We take care of transportation once the workshop starts. You know, I can help you with all that stuff. I can really answer all those questions. If you have questions, then just go again to thenimblephotographer.com, use the contact form there, you know, click the box for workshops, ask your question, I'll get back and I'll help you work through it, I'll help you get the information you need to make an informed decision. Alrighty. Now also in the show notes, or if you go to the workshops page, then you'll see the other workshops that we have going on. We have Lassen, where we're based at Lake Almanor, that's in July. And then October 1 through 3, we have the Eastern Sierra, and that's going to be based out of Bridgeport. I can answer your questions about both of those events as well. And of course, there's information on the workshops sign-up page. So go over there, take a look, figure out what you want to do. I go to workshops as well as lead them. Just having come off a really nice workshop experience, I'm jacked. I'm ready to go. It's very exciting. And, you know, I hope you get to have that experience this year as well. Okay, I have a little virtual camera club business. I want to start with our Inner Circle members. Keep an eye out. This week, we're going to have a new item for Inner Circle review. I think you'll like it. Check your email. Make sure that you're getting the notices from our Patreon site when I post stuff. And also, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your support, for helping keep this podcast on the air. I was talking with some other photographers the other day, actually when I was disappeared there for a few days. One of them, you know, asked me about, well, how do you keep your podcast so viable, and how does that work? And I said, you know, the bedrock of this podcast is our community, and they support us in a number of different ways. They support us through Patreon. They support us, you know, by attending workshops. They support us by donating film cameras. You know, they support us because this is important to them, and I let them know how much I appreciate that, and I try to come up with goodies for them as well. And it's interesting to watch other photographer podcasters and stuff just look at me and go, like, how do you, like, get that going? And I go, you know what? It starts with loving your community. And if you show them respect, then they will, a lot of times, will reciprocate. And that's what we have going on here. Thank you, Patreon members, for, you know, your participation and dedication to keeping this community well and vibrant and thriving. We have tiles for both B&H and Amazon on all the pages of the Digital Story. And we have links in the show notes to items at B&H. And if you click on one of those links, or if you click on the tile, that has affiliate code in there. You won't notice any difference. You know, you can just browse B&H or Amazon just as you normally would. But if you make a purchase, that helps support the site. And I appreciate you starting at the Digital Story before you do your shopping on either of those two sites. It really helps us a lot, and thank you so much. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the longest running sponsor of The Digital Story. They are the people in the know when it comes to inkjet printing. They have amazing paper, as you already know. They have a terrific site, as you probably have already explored, with reviews, with supplies, with tutorials on how to do things. If you want to start making prints, if you want to complete what I consider the cycle of being a visual artist, then go to Red River Paper. Just click on the tile that's on any of the pages of The Digital Story. Go over, explore, or you can go to their Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. And a big thanks to them for not only supporting this podcast, but for making the world of inkjet printing viable and happening. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me. I've got lots of exciting stuff to talk about this week, so you might want to hang around the site. Keep your eye on our Facebook page or the Twitter feed or thedigitalstory.com. You don't want to miss what's going down. I think you'll like it a lot. Until we meet again next week, have a great week. Bye-bye now.